afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the fourth broadcast in a series of lectures on social justice. I am authorized to announce that those of you who desire to possess the three preceding lectures, together with today's, may have a copy of the same. They are printed in one book and are prepared for distribution almost immediately. Together with this book, Father Coughlin is mailing out a second book, for which there is no cost, written by Pius XI on the subject of social justice. To secure these two books, even though you can afford to make no contribution, simply write a letter this week to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Hundreds of thousands in this audience will welcome this opportunity not only to receive a copy of Father Coughlin's dissertations, but to possess the most valuable piece of literature published in the last 40 years on social justice and written by perhaps the most eminent scholar in the world. The mailing address to secure your copies is the Reverend Charles E. Coughlin, Royal Oak, Michigan. Today's address is entitled Social Justice and Communism. Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, my friends. I'm impelled to express the following thoughts before delivering the address scheduled for this afternoon. Many in this audience failed to hear the broadcast which I made 3 weeks ago this afternoon, and its sequence made 1 week later, relative to the efforts being made to entangle us in the activities of the League of Nations. Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister of England, was quoted to the effect that England would not impose sanctions against Italy unless he was certain of the attitude of the United States government. His direct words I quoted. On November 18th, British sanctions and League of Nations sanctions were imposed upon Italy. Was Premier Baldwin certain of our attitude? The answer is positively yes. The proof is the following. A semi-secret ambassadorial agreement was made with the League of Nations in 1933 that America would support the League in its sanctions against any aggressor. That is startling news to all of you. On his visit to Geneva that year, Norman Davis, a fugitive from Cuban justice, a representative of the bankers of Wall Street, our ace number one ambassador, made this agreement contrary to the will of the American public and evidently at the behest of the American president. Today the international air is charged with the electricity of destructive war. Secretary Hull declares his intentions relative to oil and cotton and other sanctions. A group of Italians at Padua thereupon insulted the American flag. Be it noted that America is not at war with Italy. America is not Ethiopia, nor is it a British colony. Be it emphatically noted that we are not a member of the League of Nations, for on two specific occasions we thoroughly repudiated those who would force us into this British-controlled organization. It is also worthy of note that during the last session of Congress, legislation was passed outlawing the shipment of arms and munitions, but no mention was made about oil and cotton and foodstuffs. The expressed attitude of the American people themselves has been one of neutrality. Evidently, Stanley Baldwin recognizes the semi-secret word of an American ambassador and not the will of the American people. Thus, in accordance with the promises made by Norman Davis, contrary to the will of the American people, and beyond the powers voted by Congress under the Patman legislation, Cordell Hull threatens to prevent shipments of cotton and oil to Italy, who at no time has been hostile to the United States. If I know anything about international law or understand even in a small degree the minds of the American people who are surfeited with foreign entanglements, with foreign repudiation of debts, with foreign intrigue, Cordell Hull's pronouncement relative to oil and cotton is a veiled act of aggression. If the American flag has been insulted, the responsibility for that insult should be nailed to the flagpole of the Department of State. Because instead of retaining our virtuous neutrality towards a friendly nation, we have committed ourselves to veiled acts of aggression. Move by move, the checkers are being played, which will force us into the corner of inevitable war. In 1937, our ears will be attuned to the blast of trumpets, to the rumble of drums, as the jobless American youth will be herded to the slaughterhouse abroad, unless the foreign policy of minding England's business is summarily repudiated. This is not a question of loving England or hating Italy. This is a question of loving America, of holding fast to our traditions of no foreign entanglements, instead of attempting to out-league the League of Nations. I wonder if after all our canting and ranting about democracy, if we, the beloved American people, are nothing more than cannon fodder for diplomatic plutocrats. Those internationalists among you who wish America to meddle with foreign affairs, those lovers of the League of Nations, answer me this question. Why does the League of Nations sit like a petrified corpse and without a word of protest permit Japan to seize 5 provinces of China and dominate 95 million Chinese citizens? Why did the League fail to act when Manchuria was raped? Why did the League acquiesce when England invaded Egypt? Senator Borah was absolutely correct when he said that the League is a shield for hypocrites. The Punch and Judy members of the League of Nations spring to action only and when John Bull pulls the string. You prate of weak nations. Is not Egypt a weak nation? Is not China a weak nation? You grow eloquent over justice. Does not justice insist that a robber return his ill-gotten goods? There is India, there are the Boers of South Africa, there's Germany so devastated by the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations that it turned from sanity to Hitlerism. And you vaunt the word peace when 51 nations planned a gang together to starve the women and children of Italy. For God's sakes, let's talk about America. No foreign entanglements. George Washington's motto is my motto, especially when dealing with the League of Nations. Let us remember the War of 1812. We fought it against England to contest her right to search and seizure of our vessels and their cargoes. That was her unofficial sanction in those days. We won that war. We established the principle of the freedom of the seas and the independence of American merchants to ship when and where they pleased. Must we now dishonor the dead who fought that war? Must we surrender without a shot being fired our sovereign right to the hypocrisy of the League, which exists to retain only its ill-gotten gains? All these are days more perilous for America than many of you suspect. Americans, awake! The League of Nations and its sanctions exist for but one single purpose, to act only and when British interests are at stake. If Italy has insulted the American flag, Norman Davis, our roving, raving ambassador, and Cordell Hull, our Secretary of State, together with an international-minded administration, have insulted the intelligence of the American people. Social justice and communism. Cost what it may, my friends, I will not surrender the principles of the National Union for Social Justice to any political party. I refuse to applaud modern capitalism, which the present administration protects in secret, insofar as it is flooding this nation with printing press bonds and debts which are unpayable, and insofar as it secretly supports the League of Nations. I refuse to bow in silence before this same administration, which in public comforts certain communistic principles in its attempt to scuttle the Constitution of the United States by so whipping into subservience our legislative branch of government that it is becoming nothing more than a sounding board of fantastic destruction, and by disparaging the judicial branch of government in the minds of thoughtless voters who are prone to think that the Supreme Court is hostile towards the common welfare. This must not become a government of unelected ambassadors and upstart dictators. Although Congress has the power to declare for or against war, neither modern capitalism, nor radical communism, nor a combination of both will lead us out of this depression and save America from revolution. My friends, I am interested in these things because I realize that Christianity is taught by Christ will undergo a crucifixion in this nation if modern capitalism with all its vices or radical communism with all its diseases will dominate our lives. There's no defense of an economic system that multiplies poverty for the masses. And on the other hand, there's no sanity in advocating an economic or a social system of extreme socialism and unintelligent communism. Of this, permit me to speak. Extreme socialism or communism believes in the following principles. 1. It is unconcerned about the sublime end for which man was created. Therefore, it is hostile to religion, which it describes as the opium of the people. 2. While professing intense love for the individual's welfare, it teaches that the state is superior to the individual and that the individual citizen exists for the state. 3. Hence, extreme socialism and communism argue that economic production, of which they see only the material side, must necessarily be carried on collectively. This necessitates, therefore, that individual citizens surrender and submit themselves wholly to society with the view to production of wealth. The possession of the greatest possible amount of temporal wealth is estimated so highly that man's higher good, not excepting political, agrarian, economic, or spiritual liberty, must be subordinated and even sacrificed to the demands of efficient mass production. 4. These radicals affirm that the loss of human dignity, of free will, of justified private ownership, and of the pursuit of spiritual happiness, which result from these socialized methods of production, will be easily compensated for by the abundance of goods produced in common, because the individual citizens, they say, who share in this collectivized production, each can turn his share to the comforts and culture of life. 5. While on the one hand, these extremes are unthinkable without the use of compulsion of the most excessive kind and the destruction of all private ownership respecting production, on the other hand, communism fosters a false liberty by wiping out the Ten Commandments and the concept of God from whom all liberty and authority come. The above are the 5 chief philosophic tenets of communism. I dare say they are unknown to the vast majority of those who plead the cause of communism. Naturally, extreme socialists and communists do not advertise these doctrines. In the writings of Karl Marx, of Lenin, of Trotsky, of Stalin, of many other philosophers of communism and extreme socialism, these are the principles, nevertheless, which are advocated. Turning, therefore, from the abstract to the concrete, may I submit 4 practical questions and answers relative to this strange philosophy. 1. Why did communism appear upon the stage of life? 2. Is there danger of communism increasing in America? 3. Are the principles of the communist entirely wrong, or are they half-truths? 4. Is communism or extreme socialism more Christian than is modern capitalism? The first question. As you know, the 19th century, among other things, is notable for the so-called Industrial Revolution. The invention of steam, of the power loom, of electricity, of mass production machinery, clearly indicated that society was on the threshold of overcoming the enemies of want and insecurity. The axe, the nail, the saw, the spade, these must give way to modern machinery, which in one day, under the direction of one man, was foreseen to produce more than a score of men could accomplish in a week's time. Soon the ox cart will make way for the steam locomotive. Soon the lazy sails of slow-moving merchantmen will be outmoded by the smoke-belching funnel of rapid-moving steamships. Contemporaneous with the birth of mass productionism, modern capitalism began to develop. It was evident that a few fortunate men who controlled the issuance of money and credit soon would gain control of all the implements for production. It was likewise becoming an established policy that the laborer who worked in his factory would be compelled, despite the steady improvement of machinery, to work by the day or by the hour at a fixed daily or hourly wage. He was paid not for what he produced in conjunction with the capitalist's machinery, but on the basis of how long he worked. This system, which enabled the wealthy to own the factory, this system, which through the advance of modern mass production machinery siphoned most of the profits at an ever-increasing speed into the vaults of the owners directly and into the vaults of the money manufacturers indirectly, was destined to create an eruption in society. From the outset, capitalism adopted the policy of paying wages on the irrational basis of how long a laborer worked, and not on the sound basis of what the workman produced. In 1850, one laborer at one machine could produce 10 units of production. By 1900, the same laborer at an improved machine was unable to produce 100 units of production. Thus, the profits of the owners were increased at least 10 times over this period of years. But the wages, or to put it more correctly, the purchasing power of the laborer remained almost as it was 50 years before. No one denies that mass production machinery is a benediction, but no one can argue logically that the profits derived from mass production machinery should be permitted to accumulate into the hands of the owners at such a steady increase, while the wages or the purchasing power of the laborer should remain static. In the past 20 years, mass production machinery became so perfected that the entire problem of production was solved. Profits became so enormous for the owners that a plutocracy arose to dominate this world. The purchasing power or the wages of the laborer became so weakened that we have lived to witness want in the midst of plenty. Now, in 1848, Karl Marx, a German Jew who analyzed the outcome of capitalism, wrote a book entitled Das Kapital, in which he not only assailed modern capitalism as an iniquitous economic system, but in which he proposed to substitute for it a system of extreme socialism, under which the state would take over all factories, all production centers, owning and controlling them for the welfare of the state. Unfortunately, this founder of modern communism blamed religion instead of the hypocrites who parade under the guise of religion for the exploitation of the poor. He did not care to remember that it was religionists who established the Magna Carta. He forgot the struggle which religion had waged against feudalism. Emphasizing the Judases, he erased from his memory the life of Christ and his preachments, the doctrine of Thomas of Aquin and Bonaventure, together with the history of the untold thousands of devoted men who inveighed against those who devoured the homes of widows and orphans. In brief, communism was in irrational revolt, excogitated by an atheist against an irrational system of economics protected by hypocrites. It appealed to those who were exploited then as of today. It appealed to those who suffered unchristian injustice in a world that mouthed honey words of liberty. Oh, the lash of the Cossack, the frost of Siberia, the poverty of Limehouse, the slave wages of factories, the closed doors of defaulting banks, the protected privileges of initiated plutocrats, these and 10,000 other inequalities easily bred within the minds of disillusioned people the festering radicalism of red communism. It was a logical outgrowth of an illogical system of economics when you consider the soil of oppression upon which its seeds were sown. That, my friends, is the why of communism. That is the fundamental reason why in 1917 its preachments ensnared the Russian Empire. That is the fundamental reason why in our colleges and schools, in our pulpits and in our government, communism has taken hold today. The policies of capitalism have bred communism. Let no one deceive himself. Communism is a reality which will subjugate both America and the world, despite the puny efforts of plutocratic propaganda and opposition. There is nothing standing between our children and their enslavement to the fanatical regime of the Soviet, except the cross of Christ and the principles of social justice for which he died. Communism has a just complaint. Christianity, not modern capitalism, has the only answer. This statement leads to the second question which I propose. Is there danger of communism increasing in America? The answer can be very brief. Communism is in our midst simply because the same causes which generated it in Russia are at work in a more acute manner in America. In no land has there been such a combination of mass production machinery, of cunning fingers, of clever scientists, and of human energy as in our country. Surpassing Europe in all these benedictions, we were engaged until 1918 not only in supplying America with its economic necessities, but in producing for a backward Europe the 1,000 articles born from machinery which she could not produce for herself. To a great extent, that day has ceased. During the World War, we not only sacrificed the flower of this nation to assist one capitalistic empire in waging battle against another, we not only loaned billions of dollars in untold raw material both during the war and after the war to help revive those weakened nations, more than that, and this is an important consideration, we sent our blueprints, our machinery, and our technical brains to Europe to build up competitors for American products. Our export trade, which normally amounted to 5% of our production and which normally represented our national profit, was paralyzed. A second equally important consideration is this. During the war years, newer and better machinery had been evolved in our factories. The speed-up system had been perfected. The profits accruing to manufacturers had increased. So had the cost of living for the consuming public. The necessity of operating our lathes and our looms, our drills and our presses, for 12 months a year was at an end. The economic strain became so acute that the meager purchasing power doled out to the laborer on a pay-while-you-work policy necessitated fewer hours and less pay for those engaged in production. Meanwhile, America was staggering through the silk shirt era. Nightclubs and dancing halls, a multiplication of theaters and divorce courts, were gradually sapping the religious morality from a people who were pleasure-bent. The great God of America was material success. Our school system, which leaned backwards in its endeavor to be impartial to any religion, taught little of godliness and less of Christianity. The census of the United States Bureau of Statistics informed us that more than 60% of our people professed no affiliation with any church whatsoever. Too often the churches themselves fail to emphasize the virtues of Christian justice and charity. Too often the pulpit sounded the sophism of communism. Or as in the days of the great prophet, they preached peace when there was no peace. No wonder communism has obtained a foothold in this nation. No wonder that its principles are voiced in our federal government, as I pointed out last Sunday. According to the Los Angeles Examiner, in a dispatch published November 9, we read the following, quotes, "Two former presidents of the communistically inclined Commonwealth College of Arkansas are members of the Roosevelt Brain Trust, it was revealed today. Both figured prominently in a sweeping investigation made of the college, known as the Communist University, by a joint committee of the Arkansas legislature. The investigation revealed atheism, communistic teaching, free love practice, nudist bathing, and that the students are taught to join left-wing labor movements and stir trouble between employers and employees. The Roosevelt administration appointed one of the college heads, Dr. W.E. Zook, to be chief of the planning division of subsistence homesteads of the Interior Department. The other, Dr. Lucian Koch, also a former director of Commonwealth College, is now an assistant chief of the Consumers Division of NRA, which is advising the president on consumer problems," unquote. My honest observation is this. Want in the midst of plenty proves to every thinking person that our economic system of capitalism, not our factories, our raw resources, our scientists and our laborers, mind you, but that our economic system of capitalism is at fault. Capitalism, as was operated here and abroad for the past 150 years, is hopelessly gone. Communism will surely gain the ascendancy unless Christian social justice saves the day. And for the third question, are the principles of communism half-truths, or are they whole lies insofar as communism, or even radicalism, touches the economic lives of all citizens? Before answering this question, let it be recorded that long before modern capitalism was ever cradled, Christianity taught and still teaches that the individual does not exist for the state, and that private property can neither be taxed out of existence by the state, nor promiscuously confiscated by the state, or by a group of privileged citizens within the state. Capitalism is only 150 years old. These two principles, the relation of the individual to the state and the so-called sanctity of private property, are Christian principles, not capitalistic principles. I express these thoughts because many ignorant modern capitalists claim that these principles belong totally to capitalism because capitalism professes a belief in them, but not a practice of them. All the principles of capitalism are not erroneous. Therefore, on the other hand, there are some half-truths in communism. For example, there are some activities and properties so essential for the public good that they should not be owned or operated by private individuals. How about the army, the navy? Public ownership of certain properties is in harmony with Christian teaching. Secondly, individualism cannot be pushed to such extremes under capitalism that it becomes superior to the state and hostile to the welfare of its citizens. Therefore, a group of millionaires, cannot use or refuse to use their wealth against the common interests of the people. This principle is plain from one simple consideration. If I own a motor car, I may not drive it on the wrong side of a crowded thoroughfare at 60 miles an hour. Ownership does not permit unlimited use. I may not use it as I please. Ownership and use are philosophically and clearly distinguished. The capitalist who identifies ownership and use is seriously in error. The communist is partially correct when he leans to the doctrine of common welfare, which is not only a Christian doctrine, but an American doctrine. Again, the communist is partially correct when he seeks the common and general advantage of all mankind. He exaggerates and overstresses this doctrine, however, when he measures the advantages accruing to mankind only by the yardstick of material prosperity. It has ever been the mind of Christian teachers, nevertheless, that it is difficult for men and women who suffer unnecessary poverty to live moral and spiritual lives. Every priest knows this. Every minister of religion knows this. You can't blame the poor people all the time for some of the misdemeanors which society has forced upon them. Again, the communist expresses a half-truth in his doctrine of revolution against the iniquities of capitalism. A bloody revolution? No! A democratic revolution, as can be managed in this country? Most certainly. I do not believe in the doctrine of peace at any price. I believe that under given circumstances there may arise a crisis in the life of any nation when it is more honorable to revolt for the sake of justice than it is to play the pacifist and thus cooperate with injustice. Communism and extreme socialism are infiltrated with half-truths which make an appeal to thoughtless minds which are unconscious of Christian truths. Nevertheless, my friends, the appeal is being sounded. Thus, the contest which the world and America will witness in the next 20 years is one between unbending capitalism and fanatic communism. The radicals of the left are forming their battalions against the radicals of the right. Modern statecraft, modern finance, and modern industry seem to have forgotten that a carcass of decayed meat cannot help but breed maggots. They fail to remember that before you can remove the effect, you must remove the cause that produces it. Capitalistic industry must so share the profits with labor that a decent living annual wage is applied to every American willing and capable of working. Otherwise, capitalism will go the way of feudalism. In 1917, communism was more or less contained within the boundaries of Russia. Today, it holds sway over more than one-third of China. Its numbers have increased in Germany, in France, and in England. To the south of us is Mexico. A communistic government is there, representing 5% of the population and dominating the lives of 40 million Mexicans. It is a government that was fostered and set up under Woodrow Wilson's presidency. He sent arms and ammunition to the rebel communists while preventing means of help arriving to those who fought against it. It is the same communistic government which is fully recognized by the Roosevelt administration today. While on this point, I see nothing to recommend the recognition of either Russia or Mexico any more than I'd recognize and fraternize with a scarlet woman living in my neighborhood, especially when she's the purveyor of disease and bent upon destroying the sanctity of my family. I have in my hands proof of this Mexican communism, which our federal government is comforting. It's an official document entitled Ideologic Declaration, and issued by the Directory of Federal Education in Mexico. The third article in this document insists that teachers inculcate communism in the minds of the children. The fourth article declares categorically that no teacher may profess religion of any kind. Another article insists that each teacher in Mexico must take an oath to profess atheism, to hate Christianity, and to do all in his power to breed communism. I have a second document in my hands, issued officially by the Mexican government under their Secret Service Department, that the branch of the Mexican government spends $2,000 every week in a certain district to propagate communism, and that this money comes from Russia. That I can prove. This money is ordered from a communistic institution known as the Bank of Mexico, to whose officials last year President Roosevelt listened when they complained about the silver traffic. Nobody wants this government to interfere in Mexican affairs or in Russian affairs. We do insist that they stop interfering in the disparagement of those Christians who are endeavoring to overthrow communism in Mexico. Christians who dare to revolt, if you please, because revolution is better than peace at any price. Recognition of a professed Mexican communistic government is not in keeping with the doctrine of neighborliness, nor in harmony with the constitution of our nation, which is fundamentally opposed to atheism, to communism, and to all such subversive doctrines. But unfortunately, like another roving, raving Ambassador Davis, we have a second ambassador in Mexico and a Secretary of State at Washington who seem to welcome the presence of a harlot on our back doorsteps. Certainly, my friends, I have dedicated my life to fight against the heinous rottenness of modern capitalism because it robs the laborer of this world's goods, because it robs us all of the next world's happiness. I fight against communism. But blow for blow, I shall strike against communism. For what I do not plan to be squeezed to death between these two economic and unchristian forces, capitalism and communism. I care not whether the purblind capitalist or the crimson-lipped communist hate me. There are things too precious in life to sacrifice for either one or the other. And among these things are the little children growing up in our schools, about to be victimized either by the poverty and economic slavery of the one, or by the atheism and the immorality of the other. In my hand at this moment, I have a piece of cotton cloth, which everyone in this church audience sees that I have. It's dyed red with the blood of one of the first priest martyrs of Mexico. He had both the intestinal fortitude and the spiritual courage to defy Kyers and his gang of Russian and American-supported communists. I refer to Father Michael Pro, a brave Jesuit priest who today is in heaven. Before I came to the microphone, I stood before his picture, which hangs in my study wall, and clasped fervently this souvenir of his blood-stained shirt. I still see the picture as I speak these words. And there he is, standing against a stone wall. 20 yards in front of him is a group of Mexican communist soldiers, their guns pointed at his heart. 8 years ago, yesterday morning, those guns shot leaden hate into his heart because he taught little children that there's a God, that there's a morality, that there's a Christ still reigning in heaven, whom the communists of Mexico are crucifying once again and receiving as their reward the applause of the United States government. You think communism is not rampant in this nation?
when under the veil of neighborliness, the representative of the American government indirectly condones such murder and immorality. Father Pro, you've not died in vain. We'll fight communism. We'll fight capitalism. Christianity must prevail. Think not these things. Because the National Union for Social Justice and every member who this day renews his pledge in its principles, we'll all prefer to follow Father Michael Pro either to his capitalistic or communistic death, rather than surrender to pussyfooters and temporizers and professional fence straddlers. This is not a Catholic question. It's an American problem. Because according to the Christian Index, the Baptists of Georgia have protested. The Methodists of the South have protested. The Jews have raised their voice. The Puerto Rico Evangelical Protestant Review says that Christianity is shackled in the dungeon of governmental tyranny in Mexico. This is an American question, which is Americans, we demand that our government quit interfering in Mexico. I repeat that we do not want our government to interfere there. We want it to stop interfering. Mr. Roosevelt's recent answer to the Christians of this nation, however, is nothing more than an open invitation to Cardenas and the rest of the communists in Mexico, who control the money and the munitions and the arms, to do whatever they want to religion and its followers. Thus, my friends, I have but two more minutes left at my disposal. Capitalism is not the system that can bring us safely through this revolution of communism. Communism is not the system that can guarantee our happiness in this world and our immortal salvation in the next. Behold the Chrysler Institution. $31 was the price for their stock but 1 year ago. Today it is $87. The owners of industry have increased their wealth almost three times. 78¼ an hour for labor a year ago, the same today, only the cost of living has decreased their wages by 30%. If capitalism is smart, is wise, it will begin to pay part of their profits to institute an honest living annual wage for the American public, or else, God help all of us. I'll be glad to send you a copy of this discourse, together with the three previous ones, and also Pope Pius XI's book on social justice, by writing to my address at Royal Oak, Michigan.
Just address your letters to the Reverend Charles E. Coughlin, Royal Oak, R-O-Y-A-L-O-A-K, Michigan. This is Charles Penman speaking.